Good evening, everyone. Welcome to the Poison Pen. Tonight, we have the pleasure of meeting two people we've never hosted before. Stan Parrish, author of a wonderful new book called Love and Theft, and Jason Kaufman, his legendary editor, whom I have long wanted to meet. So this is a really selfish event for me. The reason that we are not showing you Stan's wonderful new book is that all of our copies are currently at Stan's house back east, and he will be signing them on Monday and sending them to the bookstore, where it will be our September book of the month. Oh, thank you very much. I was hoping somebody had a copy. That's a beautiful cover. I love the gemstone effect. It's gorgeous. So what I did do was I put up copies of two of Jason's author Dan Brown's most legendary books, Angels and Demons, and guess what? The Da Vinci Code. So that when I introduce Jason, we can reference those. So let me tell you about Jason. He's been in publishing for 30 years. He's vice president and executive editor at Doubleday. He edits a wide variety of thrillers, including Dan Brown, The Da Vinci Code, and others. He's also edited authors that you know and we love, such as Lincoln Child, Jeff Lindsay's Dexter series, Robert Crais, Jeffrey Archer, Clive Cussler, whom we miss terribly. We were Clive's home bookstore, so we really miss Clive. John 12 Hawks and Christopher Wright. In addition to loving suspense fiction, Jason's an avid sports fan and runner. On the nonfiction side, he edits books about sports and sports writers such as John Feinstein. So a really varied talent. Stan is the former editor-in-chief of The Future of Everything at the Wall Street Journal, and his writings appeared in GQ, Esquire, Surface, New Jersey Monthly, Wall Street Journal, New York Times, New York Times Magazine, among other publications. He holds a brown belt in Brazilian Jiu-Jitsu, which is probably helpful blocking out some of the action scenes in your novel. And he recently celebrated his birthday in Barcelona. Now, we started this project in June because that's actually when the book published. And I was okay with that until I found out that he had been in Barcelona this summer for his birthday. And I'm still sulking that I wasn't there with you. But in any case, his new book, which is, as I mentioned, Love and Theft, is something of a pivot from his first novel, Down the Shore. He pivoted to crime, and possibly the influence of Robert Stone's 1975 National Book Award winning novel, Dog Soldiers, might have factored into this decision. So, gentlemen, I'm going to turn it over to you because I'm sure that you honed your editorial conference skills, and this will just be a more fun version.
Well, thank you. I really appreciate you having us, Barbara. And, you know, to you and to Poison Pen, it's just so heartening right now to have incredible bookstores to help keep us all entertained and challenged, and not to mention sane at this moment, you know, especially during the last 5 months. So, you know, I can certainly say that authors and publishers and readers appreciate not only your expertise and your passion, but your dedication. So it's great. Very happy to be here. Thank you.
Thank you for having us.
And Stan, you know, we usually, you know, talk on the phone or talk in person, but this is really cool to be doing, you know, chance to kind of hang out and, you know, not only talk with each other as we do a lot, but to talk with Barbara and everyone about Love and Theft. So so welcome, and it's good to see you. And now you're traveling now, or you're home? You're not traveling, are you?
Yeah, no, I was in Europe for almost 4 months, and I'm up in Maine right now, just spending some family time before heading back over there. So brief sojourn in America, and then thanks to an Italian passport, it's back to Europe for a little while.
Very cool. Well, we're going to get to that because I have some questions for you about travel and what it means to you and how you incorporate it into the book and in your writing. So let me just start with, you know, there's so much that I loved about this book, and I'm not sure if most people who are watching have read the book or have not read the book, so we'll try to avoid spoilers, but there really was so much in here, and I'll start by asking you for the quick origin story. I've heard you tell it, just kind of about where you grew up and what you witnessed in your hometown, and, you know, how it got you thinking and how these ingredients would combine to make a terrific thriller. You want to get into that a little bit?
So yeah, as I told you, I think even in like one of our earliest conversations, I told you sort of where the kernel of this idea came from. But I grew up in Princeton, New Jersey, down the road from this little kind of, you know, one horse airport that was just a couple of outbuildings and a landing strip. And there was this rumor when I was growing up that the airport had been the center of this huge drug trafficking ring, that they were flying drugs in from the Caribbean to this little airport that no one was really watching. And there was rumors that the local police were being cut in on it because the drugs weren't sort of hitting the streets. In Princeton, they were looking the other way, and that there was sort of like a political element to it. And I didn't really believe it. You know, it's one of those things that sounds like suburban legend on its face. You know, it was a good story. I kind of wanted to believe it, but it just didn't line up. And then I started asking around. There was a criminal attorney who confirmed it to me. My dentist weirdly cleaned the teeth of one of the pilots who was making runs back and forth to the Caribbean. And then, you know, gradually after putting the pieces together, I was like, so what this means is there were all these kind of like master criminals hiding in plain sight in this sort of bucolic suburban community. And that is the idea that really sort of stuck with me. And that's what gave me the idea to write a thriller about a sort of a master criminal, the leader of a sort of record-breaking armed robbery crew, who in between jobs goes to this really, you know, sort of quiet, picturesque suburban community to lay low.
Yeah, it's really cool. And I actually am always interested in hearing from, you know, my authors at the beginning of the process, usually what inspired the idea and where it came from. And you know, I've heard a lot of cool stories, but that's really cool. And especially because, I mean, who would have thought Princeton, right? I mean, you just would not, you wouldn't associate that, would you?
It's not the first impression that it gives is, you know, like a den of thieves and drug dealers. It's not really what it looks like on the surface.
Was it well known there or no?
It was funny, like the more I dug into it, the more like everyone knew someone who was sort of either peripherally involved or knew about it. And it was people who were obviously basically a generation older than me, because the word is that it stopped sometime in the 80s or 90s. But yeah, it was like, it was one of those rumors that had just persisted. I figured it was just a good story, but in fact, it happened.
Yeah, and you know, I was going to get into this with you later, but maybe we'll kind of get into it right now because it seems like it's connected. You know, you've done a lot of nonfiction writing, and you've written for, you know, the Wall Street Journal, and you've written for GQ and Esquire. And I think a lot of thriller writers have not had the experience of writing nonfiction, or have not had a journalistic experience. And it's interesting to me, I just was wondering how you would see this. Does that change the way you look at writing? Do you draw on your experiences more? Do you, does a manuscript that you're writing that's fiction have to, you know, hit all the requirements that you would have normally in journalism, as opposed to sort of making everything up, where the details have to be right, the planning has to really make sense? I mean, does that stuff come into play when you're working on fiction?
Yeah, I mean, I spent years as a magazine and newspaper writer and editor, and it had a couple of influences on me. One, being an editor just made me a better writer, because after looking over other people's writing for years and spotting problems, I think you just learn how to do that a lot more easily in your own work. But I had this kind of dream job in my early 20s where I was, I started out as the assistant to the editor-in-chief at GQ, and I was booking his vacations. I was his, you know, I was his assistant in sort of the Devil Wears Prada days of Condé Nast. And at some point he was like, you're really good at this. He's like, you find all these places that I had never even heard of, you know, how are you doing this? And that kind of travel research had always been really interesting to me. And so he then put me in charge of running travel coverage for the magazine. So then I spent the next 3 or 4 years just traveling the world and writing, and, you know, filing stories for GQ. But, you know, I mean, I think all of my fiction has a heavy international component, because that has always been what's really inspired me. And, you know, I learned when I was really young how to capture the essence of a place in 75 words. You know, there was a lot of times when we were putting together these magazine travel packages where, like, you had to sell a destination in this much copy. And it really gives you a knack, I found, for finding the details that matter and really convey a sense of a place as economically as possible. So yeah, I mean, I would say that was sort of the big, you know, it's like, what if I have two sentences to capture your attention and give you a sense of what this room feels like, or what this restaurant, or what the chef's food tastes like, or what this the vibe of this hotel is, how do I do that really, really quickly? And that I would say that made my job as a thriller writer a lot easier, because you can, you know, you've sort of been trained from a very young age to convey that stuff quickly, and then you can sort of move on, you know, because in a thriller, obviously, you know, I mean, you and I have talked about this a lot, like the plot's got to keep moving. So there's not room for like a ton of lengthy exposition, you know, waxing poetic about, you know, the sunsets over Tulum Beach, but you still got to make people feel like they're there.
Actually, the thing that you do so well, and actually you touch on like five things that I'm going to get into with you, but the thing that you do so well in the book is it is really economically described. And the descriptions are not only sort of short and sweet, but very memorable. I mean, I the first time I read the manuscript, I came away remembering a lot of just little turns of phrase that enhanced the experience and made it very real. And I'll actually sort of get into, I mean, just talking, you know, turning to the manuscript a little bit. I'll shift maybe to an editor's perspective. You know, I get asked a lot, what is the, you know, what's the way that you find books? You know, how do you find books that you want to publish? Because there are lots of publishers, there are lots of editors. And I think that everybody finds different manuscripts that they love. And in terms of, you know, I'm not sure that that you know this story about kind of what my first reaction was when I read the manuscript, but I thought that I would tell you. You know, most things come from literary agents, obviously, and they do a lot of reading and find things that they love, and they send things to editors who they think will really enjoy them. To me, you know, when you get something in, we do a lot of reading, and a lot of things are perfectly great, but they don't. They just don't feel right. You know, it maybe doesn't grab you, or maybe it feels familiar, or maybe it starts with a great premise, but it doesn't hold together for you, or the characters become uninteresting or something. But it's a real high wire act to stitch all those ingredients together in a thriller. I mean, it's actually not easy to write a thriller, because it's so easy for it to become slow or long or boring or somehow not credible. And my experience really falling for this was, you know, maybe 18 months ago, Stan has this terrific agent, Julie, and she gave me a call and said, I have a wonderful writer, and he's, you know, he's written one novel that was sort of a suspense coming of age novel. And, you know, this is a new thing he's written, and it's a heist novel, which really appealed to me, because I, you know, love a good sort of heist crime thriller. And from the first page, I was just completely hooked. I can remember, in fact, just in the other room, lying there on the couch and reading basically all night. And the opening 20 pages, I know I've told you this, which if you haven't read the book, the opening 20 pages is a detailed prologue. It's slick. It's about a meticulously planned Vegas robbery. But the thing that grabbed me was that it is told in these alternating perspectives. So it intercuts between, you know, cops and bystanders and store clerks and a team of people who are pulling off the crime, these black clad motorcycle riding guys who are racing down the inside the hallways of this huge Vegas casino on their bikes. It was just electrifying. And I think that rotating perspective grabbed me, and I thought, okay, I know what this book is going to be, and I like it. It's going to be this the whole way through. Well, I turn the page, and after the prologue, the entire thing changes. And it's now becomes kind of a really interesting story, but led by a charismatic guy you meet in a low-key sort of suburban social drug gathering. And then by the next chapter, you're meeting this charming, beautiful caterer who he meets, and maybe they share a common past. And you know, and then suddenly you're in Mexico, and then it goes from there, and it becomes this this thriller that has these enormous family implications, and it is a high wire act. And so I was amazed at the way you pulled off so many different pieces of thriller writing in one manuscript, and it was not linear, and it was not really cramped into one narrow genre. And I guess what I've always wondered is that the way you set out to write it, or was is that kind of a daunting concept, and you were expecting it to go one way from the beginning, but it just sort of ended up evolving this way?
I mean, I was feeling it out, it was my first time doing it, and a lot of it was sort of happy accidents, and then there was a bunch of stuff, as I'm sure you recall, where I was like, Jason, I need a little more time to figure out the end. There was these moments where I mean, I'm so glad that you were into the prologue, and then I had, in the middle of edits, the realization that the end had to sort of mirror that in a different way. Like the prologue, you see a robbery from the perspective of everyone but the people committing the robbery, and so then there's another big heist at the end, and I was like, oh my God. As difficult as that was to pull it off, I have to do that, but take it a step further, because you now have to be in the heads of the people committing the crime, and that felt like the only way to sort of bookend it and wrap it up in a way that felt satisfying and also spoke to the beginning. But that took me, it took me a while to figure that out. And then it took me, a couple months to write. So it was like, I sort of laid the groundwork accidentally without realizing it. I couldn't figure out why the ending didn't feel satisfying. And then I was like, you already gave yourself a blueprint for how to do this. It's just going to be much harder to pull off. I was sort of feeling my way through it. And then, just going back and again and again with Julie and then with you, and just, getting those scenes, how much time do we really need to spend in Tulum? Like, yes, it's fun, but like, let's, chop, chop, let's keep things moving. And so, yeah, it was, as my first thriller, it was definitely a learning experience. And I think, next time there's stuff that I figured out from this one that will make my life a little easier, but yeah, it was, but I feel like some of the accidents are what give the book, some of the spontaneity, I think. Like they're like really sudden location changes, which are things that just came to me out of nowhere that ended up working. And there was a lot of those that ended up on the cutting room floor, as you know.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, and actually it's true, because for this book, sometimes a book comes in and you feel like a lot doesn't end up on the cutting room floor. In this case, maybe a lot did, but you had so many good things to choose from. And I feel like the combination of the traveling you've done, I mean, I assume that you've spent a good amount of time in all the locations in this book, right?
Yeah, definitely. Yeah. It was heavy research on the travel front.
Exactly. And, it's just, it was so real and so vivid. And I think you mentioned sort of like spending the time in Tulum, that midsection of the book, and trying to get in and get out. But really, it's funny, because when I was looking back through in the last day or two, just in thinking about what we're going to talk about tonight, it occurred to me that it seems to me that there's so much time spent in Tulum. And in fact, it's not as much as I thought. And again, that gets back to that, economy of description and words. There's a lot that's very memorable, but it's really done efficiently. I was going to ask you, you were talking about, kind of process a little bit. What is, I think that most writers have a very inflexible routine when they're writing. And, you're either someone who has to wake up at 4 a.m. and you only write between 4 and 10, or you've got to, get your mind churning and it's later in the day, or it's under certain circumstances. I know that for you, you had a really interesting, different kind of experience, because, it started with the lost laptop and led to a whole different process. Do you want to just talk about that for a sec? Because I always thought that was kind of cool.
Yeah, I mean, it's funny. I wrote both of these novels while working full time, so I couldn't sort of afford to be precious about when I wrote. I wrote, I was traveling a lot for work, so I wrote in airline lounges and in hotels on weekends in between assignments. And it taught me to be able to work anywhere, which, I feel really fortunate to be able to do, given that I spent the last couple months bouncing around Europe working whenever and wherever I was. But the thing that really that sort of drove that home for me is Julie, my agent, and I were talking about when we would submit the book, and I was like, look, I just need like a block of time away from my job. I was running a magazine at the Wall Street Journal at that point, and I went to Spain. I planned to go to Spain, and you know, I packed my laptop and my notebooks, and this was going to be like the 10-day period where I really knocked out the ending of the book. And then I woke up in Spain after, you know, an 8-hour flight, and my backpack felt kind of light. And I realized that was because I had left my laptop at JFK in security. So I had like a panic attack. But what ended up happening was I started writing on my phone because it was the only thing that I had. And the parts of the ending that had been really difficult for me, once I was writing on my phone, and like, I still don't totally understand what it was. I think it's like, you know, we write on our phones all the time, sort of automatically without thinking, you know, we fire off a text without too much thought, or an email, or, you know, tap out a comment on Facebook or Instagram. And there was something about writing in that mode where it just sort of became automatic. And all of a sudden I had like, I blocked out the ending, and then I started writing it, and I was like, wait, this is kind of good actually. Like this, you know, it definitely needs some polishing, but like, I wrote most of the last third of the book on my iPhone, you know, driving around with my friends in southern Spain. So, I mean, yeah. But anytime someone asks me about process, I'm like, my process is chaos. The more chaos, the better I work, which, you know, everyone has a different thing, but yeah, the less structure for me, the better.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's actually pretty fascinating because it frees you up to be a little more spontaneous and yeah, just kind of tap into the vibe of where you are, right? Because it, you know, you were a lot of this. There are parts in this book that have to do with, you know, that are in clubs and electronic dance music and all that kind of stuff. I mean, one of the characters in here who I love, named Paula, who is the daughter of the main character. You know, she has experience being a DJ, and those scenes are so vivid and so really cool. I mean, it just kind of makes you want to grab a tequila and be there. And, you know, and I think that it seemed to me like you really did tap into where you were and what was going on and the kind of vibe that you were in at the moment, which I liked a lot.
I mean, part of it for me was those locations, you know, like terrible things are happening to those characters in those locations a lot of times, but they're places that I have a lot of affection for, you know. Yeah. So it was like, it was fun to inhabit them. And then of course you're like implementing these nightmarish plot twists to the characters who are in those spaces. But it was, you know, it was a little bit of mental vacation for me in some senses, writing about places that I really, that I love and that I've spent a lot of time. And, you know, that were, you know, it's funny, the last third of the book originally was set in New York. And when I lost my laptop in Spain, I was trying to figure out, in order to end the book in the way that I wanted, I needed a crew to sort of come in from nowhere to help the protagonist pull off this last heist. And I mean, I told you the story, but I was in southern Spain with a friend of mine, and he took me, my friend who was showing me around Spain when I lost my laptop is a retired bullfighter. He's my age, but he spent 6 or 7 years bullfighting in Spain before moving into finance. And after I lost my laptop, he was like, you know what? He's like, what are you going to do? Let's go to a party.
Well, and he took me to this is a great thing, right? Spent 6 years bullfighting before moving into finance. That's perfect.
Yeah. That's
something I've never heard before in my life.
He leads a rich and interesting life. But he took me to a party at the home of a bunch of these guys who he'd been bullfighting with, and they were all sort of underemployed. And in their underemployment, you know, this was post-recession in Spain and the bull rings were closed. They all sort of turned to like various criminal activities. There was some breaking and entering going on. They were running a stash house out of their apartment. And like all of a sudden here was like exactly the crew of people that I needed to finish the book. So like I scrapped everything that I had written for the ending in New York and moved it to southern Spain, because suddenly I had these incredible characters that I frankly could never have imagined. It was almost too, you know, it was one of those moments where, you know, truth is much stranger and more interesting than fiction. And I just, suddenly I had this like picture perfect cast of criminal bullfighters. I didn't even know people like that existed, but you know, you stumble on this stuff and you just got to throw out your best laid plans and go with it.
No, it's totally true. And actually, you know, it just kind of shows the value of research and travel and writing from real experience. Because that was a really vivid piece of the book. And actually, you know, when it comes to characters, I was going to ask you, the one thing I would say that is really, I mean, I mean this as a real compliment to the book. These are some of the most well-drawn, round characters I've read in a really long time in a commercial novel, in a thriller. You know, normally, I love reading thrillers, and I will oftentimes find, you know, the characters are well-written and they're memorable and all that. But this was, you know, this almost had kind of a literary quality to the characters. I mean, the stories and their backgrounds and the pain and the family danger that happens in this book, it's really palpable. I mean, you can feel the emotion. And I think that that's another reason why it grabbed me so much. Is some of this stuff coming from experience, or is this basically conjured?
50-50. It was, in a lot of ways, the relationships, especially the relationship between the protagonist and the woman that he sort of meets and falls in love with, are based on things that are complicated relationships that I'd seen play out between people, but without those, you know, without the sort of extraordinary circumstances and life and death stakes that everything has in a thriller. And I think, you know, I always loved like a well-drawn love story in a thriller was that much more interesting, because the stakes are suddenly elevated in a way that if you manage to play that romance convincingly, it just has this whole other heightened dimension to it. You know, Dog Soldiers by Robert Stone is one of my favorite books, because there's this kind of incredible love triangle in the book that was more compelling to me than any other, you know, romance that I'd read, because these people, all three of these people, are sort of running for their lives at the same moment. And then you pour the gasoline of emotional intensity onto that raging fire. And, you know, like, that book is what made it clear to me that I wanted to do something like that. For me, it was really watching those romances be really well done in that type of fiction that was the most inspiring thing to me.
Yeah, it's a great point. And actually, it's funny that I would say, for me anyway, and I'm sure everyone will have a different take on this, but one of the best takeaways of the book was actually the fact that, the relationship between Alex and Diane, how it played out and what it became. I found there was nothing throwaway about it. I mean, it felt like a real relationship and a real romance, which right in the middle of a thriller is sometimes unexpected. But you and I talk a lot about, you know, saying, and it's always hard to tell, you know, wow, are men going to like reading this? Are women going to like reading this? And it's hard to put your finger on what the audience might be for this, because I think it really does have so many ingredients that go outside of the genre. Another compliment.
Thank you.
Well, if I can't compliment you, then who can? Because
yeah.
I'm your editor, right?
Actually, the New York Times can, and I was going to bring up something because, you know, Jason, it's the same process for me that it is for you. I'm given 200 or 300 books a month, out of which I have to decide which of the ones we're really going to support. The question I am most often asked by our customers is, how did you know? How did you know that Michael Connelly would turn out the way he did? How did you know that Lisa C? How did you know about Don Winslow? How did you know Lee Child? And, you know, what it really comes down to is I read for voice. I mean, there are a million plots, but there are not that many original plots. And voice is what does it. And I really thought that, Jason, that Adam Sternberg did a wonderful job for you in his New York Times book review when he said that the language in the book is exceptional. It's expertly and artfully written. And the attention to sentence by sentence pleasure is an undervalued, possibly disdained skill among thriller writers. But a precision cut sentence can quicken the reader's pulse as reliably as a surprise twist or a character's excruciating dilemma. So I have like a 20 page test. You know, I read 20 pages, and if the voice does not get to me, then sometimes I read a little more, sometimes I look up the end, sometimes I move on. So when Jason wrote to me and recommended your book, I had already gotten a copy of it. And I was so hooked by the way you wrote your voice in the first part that where it went was less important to me than it's hard to explain. It's a gut thing, don't you think, Jason, as an editor? You know, if your gut says to you, this one will work, why does it say that? But you're almost always right. And when your gut says it won't work, I think it's important to listen to it too.
Yeah, it's a great point. And I think that that is something that Stan does so well. And it's funny, Barbara, because you had the same experience then that I did, which I really remember just liking the construction and liking the characters and being so surprised after the prologue that the book was not just a 300 page heist. I mean, it really went in so many different places, but it didn't quite matter to me where it was going to go, because it was just so, you were in the hands of a really talented storyteller and a really good writer. And so, you know, Stan, that doesn't mean that your next book can absolutely go off the rails wherever you want it to go, but you know, there has to be some structure. But this was,
it's going to be good. Don't worry. It's going to be good.
No, but it's true. Well, no, I think that's a great comment, Barbara. It really is.
One of my favorite, because I've probably edited 800 or 900 books by now before we sold Poison Pen Press to Source Books, which is now part of Random House. And I used to say to writers or say to people when they would ask me about it, you know, said, I can help you with character. I can help you fix plot. There's a lot I can do. But if you're boring, there's nothing, you know, there's just no hope there. And so really, you know, Jason, it's like a taste of wine. People, this comes up an awful lot. I'm always saying to people, if the book isn't working for you, put it down and read another book. Because so many people are driven like to read the whole book, which is a terrible waste if you're not enjoying it, because time is what you've got. You know, that's your most precious resource. And it's hard to get that across to people sometimes. There's a guilt factor that comes in and says, no, I'm going to really plow through all 1,300 pages of this thing, whether I like it or not. And so I say to them often, you know, listen to your gut, listen to the voice. If it's not working for you, put it down. But the truth is, an editor can't fix you if you're bored. Jason can work on everything else, but the voice has to be yours. It really does.
Well, it's true, you know, and I think that, you know, certain writers are just gifted in terms of they can write a couple of sentences and it really draws you in and it's beautifully done. And that can be whether you're a literary writer, whether you're a commercial writer, no matter what, you know, there are certain people who just have a certain magic touch. And, you know, Stan is certainly in that category. And you know, you're right, life is short. And the other thing is that not everybody's going to love every book. And I, you know, I've really learned that over the years. And so sometimes you just, if you have passion for it and you think that other people will, it can be a small group, a large group. And sometimes you really never know, especially in publishing, it's so unpredictable. But when you find someone who can really tell a story, like, you know, in this book, Love and Theft, it you know, you're going to find an audience somewhere, that's for sure.
I can forgive plot errors more easily than I can forgive being bored. So
yeah,
you know, it's like a palate for wine. I'm going to assume, Stan, that, you know, as you're banging around Italy, you're probably drinking a fair amount of wine, right? You're Italian.
Well, here and there. Yeah. Yeah, yes,
everybody's palate's different, right? You know, you can sit at a table with four people and, you know, you can all have a different, and books are the same. So, you know, it's important to listen to yourself.
Yeah, I mean, taste is individual. It's, if not, it's just snobbishness. Yeah, and there's no, you know, I mean, there's no accounting for it in a way. You know, it's great. It's great to see. You know, like some of the things that people have responded to in this book are not at all the things that I expected them to. They were sort of like you know, the sort of weird personal grace notes that I threw in there. You know, I don't want to say they were self-indulgent, but I was just, you know, really surprised to see other people interested in that stuff. But yeah,
you don't know how many, you never know. I have sat in front of a room full of people and watched the author's eyes kind of go like this when people would ask questions, and you could see the author going, yeah, did I say that? Or even more importantly, is that really what I meant? You know, it's so funny.
Oh, yeah.
People bring their own baggage, their own, you know, experience. Everybody reads a book differently. Every editor reads a book differently. I'm sure if you passed around a book, you know, among your colleagues at Doubleday, that you would get different reactions.
Oh, we do all the time.
And, yeah, the other thing I want to say before I shut up again, which I hardly ever do, but I will, is that I think it's important. It doesn't have to be beautiful language. It just needs to be compelling or convincing. without naming names, I can certainly say that one bestseller is, in my opinion, much as I love this person, a fairly clunky prose stylist, but so compelling, you know, that you don't. So we're not looking here for beautiful language so much as compelling language that speaks to your heart, so to speak, you know.
Yeah, and that's very often true, you know, with commercial fiction, is being able to tell the story quickly and interestingly. And, you know, in Stan's case, I think what got me excited from the beginning when I started reading this just manuscript on my computer is that the language was so good. And it was, you know, I think that the New York Times review actually called attention to that the phrase, I can kind of remember it, but I'll butcher it, but, you know, about, you know, sort of, you know, turning the color of, you know, burnt sugar or something. I mean, it was just, it really, there were so many moments in the book that that I still have, you know, vague recollections of language-wise. And I really don't usually walk away from reading commercial fiction that way.
So Patrick has appeared with what appeared to be a couple of questions. So let me let him wander up here.
All right. Okay, so one question is, which international locales do you think are underrepresented in the thriller and suspense genre?
Wow, what a great question.
International. Well, I mean, my go-to answer would be New Jersey, which I agree with Richard Ford that it's the most interesting place to write about in the world. But God, in terms of internet, I haven't read any besides, actually this is less true recently because of Jane Harper popularizing Australia with her fiction, but I would love to read more Australian thrillers. You know, I think the stuff she's done in the Australian Outback is really compelling. I would be really curious to, South Africa is a location that I've thought of setting a book, and I haven't, and I was sort of digging around, and if anyone has any suggestions, I would love to hear them. Nothing came to mind that's set there in that genre, which I think could be really interesting. Underrepresented, Canada. The Canadian wilderness in particular is an area that I'm very interested in and haven't seen a whole lot of fiction set in. Jason, anything else come to mind? You read incredibly widely in this genre.
Well, you know, I read in the genre, but I would say 90% of what I read in the genre comes in the form of submission. So then you have to sort of track whether a lot of these manuscripts that you're reading are actually getting published and where, and if they're getting attention. I've seen recently a lot that is set in Asia, in Korea, in Japan, things like that. And it's, there haven't really been many that have taken off in a big way, but I think that that's kind of interesting. And I always like, you know, wilderness areas. So I would love to read something that was in, you know, Alaska, deep in Alaska, in the, you know, in the Arctic, things like that. And you know, I mean, like Tony Hillerman famously was, you know, really turned the Southwest into a backdrop for wonderful mysteries. And I don't think many people had thought of that beforehand. So, but it's a really good question. I think there's a lot of potential out there.
Totally.
I'm gonna recommend Dion Meyer to you, who is a South African, Jason, that you might want to read. He's published Grove Atlantic.
You're right. In fact, when Stan was saying that, I was thinking of him because I have read him before, and he's very, very good. So, you know, that's something that, you know, Stan, you should take a look at. He's great.
Yeah, totally.
Really is. Plus, Patrick went up like this because he's a huge Dion Meyer fan. Watch him go. Right. Okay. Another one.
And he writes in Afrikaans originally, which is interesting.
Oh, wow.
Oh, I didn't know that. Huh.
They're translated.
Yeah. There are actually quite a few South African crime writers.
Yeah, Rogers, but they haven't done particularly well in the U.S. market, and I really don't know why. But I will say that I have said for the last year that the next big wave will be the Australian crime wave. I think the Scandinavian, we've all sort of had a lot of it,
I'm looking forward to that wave.
Yeah, I really do. There are a lot of Australian writers I could recommend to you besides Jane Harper. And I think that they are doing, also New Zealand is suddenly coming on a little bit too, which is wonderful. Another question.
All it takes sometimes is one book from one area. I mean, like if you think about the Stieg Larsson phenomenon, exactly. It was, I don't think people had really thought of Scandinavian thrillers in the US before that. And then you have this one amazing series that comes. And there have been, my God, Barbara, how many books and set in Scandinavia since then? I mean, there have been hundreds.
There have been. I think Walu, I'm trying to remember the other half of that pair, they pioneered it, but they didn't catch on in the same way that Henning Mankell, came along with his shot and brought it along too. But now, and actually, long form television is absolutely saturated in Scandinavian crime. Written by people in Finland, in Reykjavik, in wherever, and that globalization is relatively new in crime fiction. Japanese writers now being translated into the United States. It's wonderful. Carry on.
Yep. Okay. Here's another question. All right. Let's see. Lynn asks, "What are the elements that you write into a character to ensure that the reader roots for them, even if they are on the dark side of the force, as it were, like a thief? How do you make a thief sympathetic?"
I mean, you just got to make them seem human and, three-dimensional. I think it was interesting because, I never really thought of the protagonist of this book as sort of as an anti-hero, but obviously, he's breaking the law constantly throughout the book and making terrible decisions and, you have to sympathize with them as the writer. I think that's the most important thing, is you have to find this person both compelling, and it's not enough to sort of imbue them with humanity. They also need to be compelling. As we were saying before, there has to be something about them that grabs you and makes you want to tell their story, but would also make you want to listen to their story. You're looking for something to, you want to create curiosity in the reader about them. You need the reader to want to know what happens next with this person. And for me, there's a level of unpredictability that really helps, where it's like you don't feel like you know what their next move is going to be. And making a couple of really, surprise decisions for that character will go a long way in doing that. It's just making them feel like there's blood in their veins.
Excellent answer. Anything else?
Good answer. I think also, I'd say it's important to be able to understand a character. So no matter what he or she is doing, if you understand the reasons for it, I think it's easier to, in the case of this book with Alex, I never really questioned why he was doing what he was doing. But a lot of times when you read something and you do question it, then the character usually doesn't work. But the Jeff Lindsay novels that I had edited with Dexter, you can't hold Dexter up on a moral pedestal, but you can still root for him, and he's a serial killer. Yeah. But you sort of understood what he was doing, and it was about the writing. It just worked.
And that's also a great example of just making, he really made that character come to life and made him seem human through his, you're privy to his insecurities and his personal failings and all these other things. And sure, he's a serial killer. And there's even sort of a moral justification in the way that he's going about it. But the thing that made that character so compelling, I think, was that, in a way he was a very relatable serial killer. And that is not an easy thing to do. That was sort of the sleight of hand. It's like, you can recognize a lot of, your own humanity and your own personal failings in this guy who's going around and chopping people up in a million pieces and burying them all over Florida. But that's how you pull people in, is that he made him feel like a human being. And it wasn't just a character at that point. Dexter was a person in everyone's mind who read those books.
Yeah, it's true.
They're wonderful. And his last novel was a heist novel. He was here last December with it, and I thought it was an interesting transition from Dexter, to Top Copy, so to speak. It's a lot of fun. So, Jason, what are you working on? People always like to know what's coming next.
Oh, that's a good question. Well, it's always, you know, stuff that's like a year or so in the future. But at the moment, I have a couple of sports books that I'm editing, just kind of on the nonfiction side of things, which are a lot of fun. One is about this current baseball cheating scandal that was going on in the last year, which was great. And the author has a lot of inside access to that. And then the other one is my author, Lee Montville, who's just terrific. And he's, a really well-known, wonderful sports writer for decades and decades. And he's writing about the 1969 NBA finals. But there's a lot of all the undertones of race and all things that were present there. It's almost like a very similar situation to what we're in right now. So that's been a lot of fun. And I have a couple of novels coming down the road, which should be a lot of fun. And my sleeves are rolled up and working on those. So a good variety.
Wonderful. And Stan, you've mentioned you were working on something new, but can you tell us any more?
At this point, it is a very drafty outline that I'm not totally ready to share it. I'm working on a TV show at the moment, which is a TV show based on a crime story that I sort of stumbled on accidentally while reporting a Wall Street Journal profile. Without going into too much detail, there was a mixed martial arts gym in Miami that was home to a large criminal organization. Which is something that I found out completely accidentally while reporting a profile on one of the gym's fighters. And so I'm doing a TV show based on that. That's next. And then, I have a book idea that Jason's going to be getting an email about sooner or later.
Good. I was going to say that this is like a live reveal right here, because I haven't heard about it. I was going to ask you about that soon.
It's almost there. This is definitely the genre for me. It was sort of my first love as a reader, and my next book will definitely be another thriller.
Do you know what's really interesting is to see that the lines between nonfiction and fiction are being sort of soft edged by narration. I mean, we've hosted like Ariel Sabar, I'm not sure how we pronounce it. Anyway, his wonderful book a couple of weeks ago. We have Alan Foyer, who's possibly a colleague of yours at the Times. We're doing something with his book, Monday El Jefe, right? His New York Times cover. In other words, I think that being able to tell nonfiction with the same drive, the same narrative drive as fiction has made more people read true crime and nonfiction, but it also sort of working the other way, in that nonfiction is providing situations or whatever that you can translate into fiction. It's really an interesting kind of merge.
Yeah, I mean, look what Don Winslow is doing with the drug wars, and some of the most unbelievable scenes in the cartel and the power of the dog are ripped straight from the headlines. It's stuff that as the editor in me was reading those scenes and I was like, this is not credible. And then I remembered seeing the news story that was based on. It is really interesting how, that is almost a journalistic work in a way. Obviously he's fictionalized it, but I think it's really interesting to see that sort of cross-pollination between fiction and nonfiction and crime stories.
Oh, you're absolutely right. And Nicholas Griffin, John Sanders, I love doing this. Nicholas Griffin, whom I'm very fond of and wrote an 18th century historical novel that I liked, wrote to me and said he was now a reporter in Miami and he'd written a book about 1980s Miami and the cartel and the drug war and the whole bit. And he wondered if we'd like to do something. And so I immediately called John Sanford, who I knew was a reporter at the Miami Herald at that time, and asked him if he would do a program with Nick. And it was really fascinating. Well, you can watch it on our video, but they talked about that because Nicholas's book really is the thriller. I mean, it's all true, but the way he writes it
is next on my list.
So compelling. It's is it called? The Year of 100.
Dangerous Days.
Yeah, The Year of Dangerous Days. Now he's going to talk to Alan Foyer Monday night about Alan's book about Guzman, because they're both investigative reporters, so I thought that they could have a more meaningful conversation. I mean, Patrick and I are just over here, you know, two schlubs without all that experience. So that's one of the great things about Zoom, guys, is that we can put things together now that, you know, would not really have been feasible if we were all traveling. So any last thoughts, any last words here before we sign off?
No, I appreciate you having us. It's, and you're right about Zoom. It's funny. I mean, in some ways, this the last 6 months has been so limiting. But on the other hand, there are a lot of things that have been able to, you know, to happen that you wouldn't normally get pairings. And, you know, you can't necessarily get two people to come fly out west and sit down and talk. So this has been great.
It has. Yeah,
thank you so much for having us.
Oh, listen, it's been a great pleasure. And truly, we have been working on this since June. So my message when I ordered the books at the warehouse, they said, because the first printing was disappearing. And, you know, they said, order it now or you're going to lose it. And then they said, when's the event? And I said, I just hope he comes home before December. At some point, we have to pay the bill, you know, for the books. So thank you for coming back at a more opportune time. I mean, we were going to sit on them for months, but still.
I would have stayed up till 3 a.m. to do this happily, but I'm glad I can do it at 9 p.m. instead.
Well, we are too. So thank you very much. Thank you all for joining us this evening. This has been a wonderful conversation about writing. So those of you who are interested in writing or know people are interested in writing, you might want to share this video or the podcast that will turn up in a day or two when our podcast engineer, known as my husband, gets it organized. Anyway, enjoy the rest of your evening and thank you for joining us. And don't forget that Love and Theft, the autographed copies, will arrive next week, fresh from the hand of Stan Parrish. Yes. Hello. We hope you're enjoying our programs and podcasts with authors. We'd like to expand them, and your help would be appreciated. Please make a donation at poisonedpenfoundation.org. 100% of the proceeds will go to help connect authors with readers in this difficult time. Thank you.